This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast from Watchman Fellowship Incorporated. Here is your host, Staff Apologist Daniel Ray.
You are probably quite familiar with the story of Jesus miraculously feeding 5,000 people with just 5 loaves of bread and 2 small fish. The story is told in all 4 gospel accounts, Matthew chapter 14, Mark chapter 6, Luke chapter 9, and John chapter 6. But there are probably a few details you may have overlooked in the accounts, details that give them an interlocking consistency. These minor details are often called undesigned coincidences. Consider that in Luke's account of the miraculous feeding, verse 10 of chapter 9 mentions that Jesus withdrew by himself to a small town called Bethsaida. Luke notes that the crowds soon found out about this and went out to see him. And after a day of Jesus teaching about the kingdom of God and healing people, the disciples tell Jesus to send the crowds away so that they can go find lodging and buy food for themselves. But now compare what the disciples suggest to Jesus in Luke's account to what John writes of the disciples in John chapter 4, almost as an aside. In John chapter 4, we read that Jesus was alone at the well with a woman, but the disciples were not with them. John tells us in verse 8 that they, quote, had gone away into the city to buy food, end quote. So the disciples' suggestion to Jesus in Luke chapter 9, that the crowds go and buy food for themselves, is precisely something the disciples seem to be in the habit of doing. But that is not all. Later in John 6, where the miraculous feeding takes place, Jesus first turns to Philip and asks him, quote, "Where are we to buy bread that these may eat?" End quote. In Luke's account, this question is not recorded. But why would Jesus ask Philip specifically about where the crowds could go to buy bread? John chapter 1, verse 44 gives us the clue. Quote, "Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter," end quote. Recall Luke 9:10 records that Jesus went to Bethsaida where the crowds followed him. Philip was from Bethsaida. Luke doesn't mention Philip is from Bethsaida, but mentions that they withdrew to Bethsaida. John mentions that Philip is from Bethsaida, but doesn't mention that the feeding of the 5,000 takes place there. These interconnected, undesigned coincidences require a patient and careful reading of the texts, and are often easily overlooked. But once you begin to notice them, they bring out the gospel narratives in high definition. These small details interspersed throughout the separate gospel accounts are not just limited to the feeding of the 5,000. They permeate the texts and lend much credibility to their historical authenticity. These undesigned coincidences also lend weight to the fact that each narrative does have substantial independence from the others. In other words, they are not merely narratives copied nearly verbatim from a single source, as some critics suggest is the case. Rather, they each reflect the writing style and intent of their individual authors. Often you will hear a skeptic make the claim, however, that appealing to the Bible as evidence for the truth of Christianity is circular and self-defeating. If anything, these alleged undesigned coincidences are mere literary devices meant to make it look as though the accounts are true. But as Dr. Timothy McGrew, our guest again this week on The Profile, shares, this sort of objection has little merit. We appeal to dictionaries for definitions, but few make the argument that it is circular reasoning to cite a dictionary definition of a word as evidence for the meaning. If people wish to know who Jesus is or what Christians believe, appealing to the scriptures is the logical and reasonable thing to do. Tim argues we need to critically examine the broad sweeping generalizations from critics and focus more intently on the detail of what we find in the text of scripture.
People get all hung up on either the Gospels are completely independent of one another in every respect, or they're completely dependent on one original Gospel, which probably was Mark, which means everything that is in any of the other Gospels is either in Mark and therefore just copied, or not in Mark and therefore not to be taken seriously. But this kind of argument shows that that is a faulty view. there can be degrees of dependence and independence about particular passages and even particular phrases in passages. And we need to read with better resolving power in our microscopes to be able to find that level of detail.
As we begin part two, Tim unpacks for us undesigned coincidences in greater detail and encourages us to dive into this fascinating aspect of the Gospels. See the notes of this episode for a link to Tim's wife Lydia's book about undesigned coincidences, Hidden in Plain View, Undesigned Coincidences in the Gospels and Acts. Here once again is Dr. Tim McGrew.
It cannot be simply, well, they say the same thing in roughly the same words, because then there's an obvious alternative explanation. Yeah. One of them is largely just borrowing from the other. So that's, you can't do that. But there is a pattern of inference, the inference to the best explanation from undesigned coincidences, that exhibits this rather nicely. So let me just run through an example in case some of your listeners haven't heard this before. If you look, for example, at the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 14, we get the setup for the story of the death of John the Baptist. So everybody knows, what did John the Baptist do just before the beginning of Jesus' ministry? John the Baptist goes out and it's right there in his name, right? He's baptizing people and they're baptizing in the Jordan River. Herod Antipas has John imprisoned, and then in a disastrous, probably drunken moment, he tells his stepdaughter, he'll give her whatever she asks. She goes to Mama, and Mama says, get the head of John the Baptist. And so he sends his scout to the dungeons, and they cut off John's head. And he is carrying this around on his conscience when he sobers up. And then what does he hear? You know what? People are flocking to the Jordan River. Why? Well, there's this guy down there. He's baptizing them. What? And he turns to his servants and he says, what's this? I had John killed. Is he back from the dead? What's going on? You know, the miraculous powers, they say, are at work in him. I'm interested in the phrase in Matthew 14, verse 2, to his servants, because if you cross-compare this, and I do urge people to do this, if you look up the parallel passage in the other synoptic gospels where we hear about the death of John the Baptist, that phrase isn't there.
Verse 2 is, and he said to his servants, this is John the Baptist, he has risen from the dead, and that is why miraculous powers are at work in him.
Right. So in Mark's account, you'll get that Herod said, what's this? It's John the Baptist come back from the dead. But you don't get that phrase to his servants. So whatever your theory of dependence among the synoptic gospels may be, and this is a very important point, it's not complete dependence because he can't be getting that from any of the others because it's not there to be got in any of the others.
I see.
That phrase is absolutely unique to Matthew and it's in all the manuscripts. So there's no manuscript variant issue here at all.
Fascinating.
So here's the very reasonable question. And as I like to say, unless you can feel the speed bump when you're reading these things, unless you can get slightly puzzled about it, you can't have the feeling of wonder when the puzzle is resolved.
Yeah.
So you got to read actively and thoughtfully this way first. So you know a lot of skeptics. What are they going to say when you say, but he says he said it to his servants? Sure he does. He's writing the equivalent of a first century novel. He's making it up. It lends a little bit of color to it. It's not like this is something that we have to take historically seriously. Come on, it's just a flourish, right? And if all that we had were Matthew, it might not be easy to give a convincing response. Why should we not think that? Maybe we could come up with some indirect reasons. But we have four Gospels. If you go over to Luke chapter 8, it is not the story of the death of John the Baptist. Luke chapter 8 is telling us a list of people at the beginning, a list of people who supported the ministry of Jesus and his disciples. There is no parallel list in Matthew, so neither of these authors is borrowing from the other. Verse 3 names one of them. It's Joanna. Okay, well, you say that's nice. I have a name, but that doesn't really help. Okay, but who's Joanna? Thumbnail sketch, parenthetical, right? She's the wife of Chuza. Herod's
steward,
his household manager. And suddenly, it's not a mystery how Matthew, former tax collector, now a traveling preacher, could know what Herod Antipas is saying to his servants in the privacy of his own palace. Jesus' followers, serious followers, devoted to his cause, had family in the highest ranks of Herod's servants. That's an undesigned coincidence. One book brings up in passing some detail that you'll read right past if all you're doing is reading Luke. Like, okay, that was fun. I learned that there's this woman, Joanna. There's not going to be a whole lot more about Joanna, and there's going to be nothing more about Chuzah, her husband. Mm. Oh, but you cross-connect it with Matthew 14, and suddenly you realize that just answered that question.
That's
now right. I've got a totally plausible explanation for this. If it were just a one-off, if this were the only one, you might say, well, that's curious, but, you know, maybe it was an accident. Mm. But if there are dozens of them, and if they crisscross the documents in all directions, if John explains things in the Synoptic Gospels, and the Synoptic Gospels explain things in John, and the Synoptic Gospels explain things in one another, then it becomes really hard to resist the conclusion that these are documents written with some measure of independence. And again, I want to stress, people get all hung up on either the Gospels are completely independent of one another in every respect, or they're completely dependent on one original Gospel, which probably was Mark, which means everything that is in any of the other Gospels is either in Mark and therefore just copied, or not in Mark and therefore not to be taken seriously. But this kind of argument shows that that is a faulty view. There can be degrees of dependence and independence about particular passages and even particular phrases in passages. And we need to read with better resolving power in our microscopes to be able to find that level of detail and see what's going on. So here's a kind of internal evidence. Now, why is that not circular? Well, one simple answer is that John didn't write Luke, and Luke didn't write John. And the more that you know about the distinctive styles of these authors and about the historical setting and what we have from the early church fathers about who wrote them and when they wrote them, the more obvious it becomes that these documents were not written by the same person. And it's manifest that Luke did not write that passage in order to explain the weird reference in Matthew. And
right.
Matthew did not write his passage in order to tap into something that Luke said in a list of Jesus supporters.
Yeah.
I'm the son of a Bible college professor. I was raised in the church. I had to read through the Bible multiple times as a kid. And I did dutifully, right? You know, you begin at the beginning of Matthew, all right? The generations of Jesus Christ. And, you know, you start reading through all of them. You try to count and see if it's really 14 in each one. You get to the birth of Jesus. You go to the slaughter of the innocents, the flight to Egypt, and all the weird prophecy stuff. And you just go, right, sequentially through it. But this involves your reading horizontally. It involves your connecting the dots and saying, wait, what's over there? And I think I'm a reasonably attentive reader. And I did this multiple times. I never saw any of this. I never saw any of this. A good preacher sometimes will pick up on a few things like this. I did a talk here at this conference this year on this, and one of the people attending said to me later, you know, I have always been able to tell intuitively the difference between a good preacher and a preacher who's just not that good, but I never knew how to put it into words. And I think it's this. I think it's that they were seeing these connections that other people weren't seeing.
Yeah.
And so instead of just going sequentially down through the one narrative, they were pointing out these comparisons.
Yeah.
She was on fire. She was like ready to go out and study this argument in detail. And it strikes people as a revelation when they see it, and they see it in detail. So part of the answer to the circularity question is these are different documents. It happens that they've been collected by the Christians and bound into a single volume. But they were originally documents that were written by different people, and the Christians found them important, but that doesn't make them completely dependent on one another. And so we can look for these things. We can look for undesigned coincidences. I have a list of examples from secular history of the argument from undesigned coincidences, where secular historians talking about non-religious topics, oh, here's Harold, the last of the Saxon kings, and his brother Tostig, and some journey he made just before the Battle of Hastings. And they will say of certain aspects of it, this is an undesigned coincidence. They use the phrase. I'm not importing it. I'm not inferring that they would call it that. They use the phrase themselves to point out the kind of evidence that there is here. This is not just something that the Christians are making up because it supports their cause. This is a topic-neutral form of inference that is used in other contexts as well, and that we can't simply blow off or ignore.
Yeah.
And you might say, well, you're using the Bible to prove the Bible. What I'm doing is I'm cross-comparing two narratives. I'm pointing out a very indirect way in which they interlock. Mm-hmm. Not that they repeat one another, but they interlock. And then I'm asking the question, what direction does the fact of that interlocking point?
Yeah.
Is that better explained by the hypothesis that the authors are close up to the facts and habitually truthful, or by some alternative hypothesis?
Yeah.
And when consistently they point to the former, and you've got multiple facts doing that, you're building what we call a cumulative case. Forensic detection uses this all the time.
Yeah.
So there is nothing circular about doing that. It does require that we look at what the texts are saying, but then we're doing an inference to the best explanation regarding a specific kind of interlocking that's happening there. And again, if there are, as in fact there are, dozens of these things, and if they're going in all directions, it's not just like John patches up all the things that were left over that you're wondering about in the synoptics. No, they explain things in John, John explains things in them, they explain things in one another. And sometimes the things are quite puzzling until you bring the other piece of information to bear.
Gotcha.
Then you actually have a cogent form of argument, and the cogency only increases as you are able to multiply instances of it. No single argument of this form may be by itself compelling. And this is another thing that I think is just important. So I'm going to put my epistemologist hat on and do a little theory of knowledge. You can build a completely convincing case out of pieces of evidence, no single piece of the evidence being by itself convincing. And people miss that fact. And they think it's enough if I can dismiss A, and I can dismiss B, and I can dismiss C, because, well, A doesn't really prove your case. And
it's like a solid blue puzzle piece out of 1,000 puzzles.
Right,
it's like, okay, that's insignificant for now. It's solid.
Right.
You know, it's by itself, it's just blue.
But once the picture begins to come together and you've got these things interlocking and spreading out, right, how would it be with a jigsaw puzzle?
Yeah.
Well, here's the puppy's nose and his eye and part of his ear. And now are you going to listen to the clever postmodernist philosopher who comes along and says, well, really there was no puppy and there was no puzzle.
Right.
No, come on. Go away. Right? There's a picture of a puppy here.
Right.
And so you see a picture emerging and you can't unsee that at that point. And at that point, merely literary speculation, which is without any kind of check for its actually being true or false. Like, I conjecture that there was a source document and there were five layers of redaction to the source. You know, where is this source document? Don't have it. Who were the redactors? Don't know. You're off in fantasy land constructing a fantasy about the way it might have been written without anything available to hold you to the evidence and say, how will you know if you are wrong in this conjecture?
That is such a critical thing, Tim, because you hear that those conjectures, those hypotheticals, if you will, are often offered by skeptics because I don't think, well, they don't have anything really in their arsenal to object to this except for hypotheticals. Well, let's just say that there was this source. And let's just say that decades passed between the time of the writings and the time of the events that they occurred. Let's just say all this Bart Ehrman's telephone thing comes to mind.
Show me a conspiracy theory that I cannot substantiate by these kinds of moves.
Right.
You want the hypothesis that Abraham Lincoln never existed.
Yeah.
I gotcha. We're there. We can make the same moves for that. We can, well, Emancipation Proclamation. Well, what were the first sources the public received that there had been an Emancipation Proclamation at all? Newspaper reports. The newspaper reports. They were anonymous, you know.
I could say that it was a Southern general at Gettysburg who was making the address and not Lincoln himself, you know. You could go on and on this.
You know, or I can point out that in his memoirs, personal memoirs of the Civil War, Ulysses Grant never mentions the Emancipation Proclamation. How could he miss it?
Yeah.
That was designed to keep the British from coming in on the side of the South in the war. Mm-hmm. Right? How could he miss something of military and political significance? Like
Lee's memoirs are anonymously written, Tim. How about that?
Right. So, you know, you can make moves like this for anything. And it sounds hilarious and silly when we do it about Abraham Lincoln.
Sure.
Of course, Abraham Lincoln existed. Of course, there was an Emancipation Proclamation. Let's not be dumb. But when people do the same things as ways of trying to build up some fancy just-so story about how we got the Gospels and how they ended up having the things in them they did, and there's no tie-down where you can say, okay, can we just go and check on that?
Yeah.
Then we are in Wonderland. We've gone down
Absolutely.
The rabbit hole and come out in a place where everything is just open to free conjecture, and there's no place where we can hold that to account.
I talked to on the book club. It wasn't the best question I could have asked, but we had Bart Ehrman on our book club last year, a couple of years ago.
Sure.
And I asked Justin Bass. I said, Justin, what's a good question I could ask Dr. Ehrman? And he said, well, if you're going to ask him, just be ready for this. Just be ready for him to present it as though you're arguing with him, and don't let him throw up red herrings, and don't chase what he brings up, because he's not going to answer this question. Justin was right on. I mean, he was right on. I asked the question, and instantly Bart tried to change it. But my question was basically this. I can't repeat it verbatim, but it was, okay, Dr. Ehrman, what is your final explanation as a New Testament historian for why we have the Gospels if the resurrection isn't true? Mm-hmm. And Justin said, well, he wasn't going to want to commit to that, because there's really no plausible explanation that can be, as you've just eloquently said, there's no historical, archaeological, there's nothing there to support the thesis of his, again, conjecture, that it was a mistake, that
right.
the disciples were mistaken. Because it on the one hand, he's so specifically oriented to textual nuances, mm-hmm. Greeks and jots and tittles, and he'll take you down the mat with what the Greek says and what this means. But when it comes to his own hypotheses about why we have the New Testament apart from the resurrection, he's off the map. It's pure conjecture. There's complete speculation about what's going on there. And I think a lot of what I listen for now when I talk to skeptics is when they try to make solid historical claims about the New Testament. And I do exactly what you say. I said, can we look at manuscript evidence? Can we look at what manuscripts you're relying on? Tacitus and Josephus? What do you have to support what you've just said? Because a lot of atheists will say things about oral tradition or gospel anonymity or we don't know, or and I said, well, what are the historical source material that upon which you were relying to make these sort of claims? And there's nothing there. It's a lot of conjecture and hypothesis.
Right. And anybody can spin out a conjecture. My wife's first degree, her first field was Renaissance literature. Mm. So she's familiar with literary interpretation. And in fact, it was the low standard of rigor and the just disregard for canons of evidence in that field that caused her to say to me, okay, teach me probability theory and logic, and I need to get into analytic theory of knowledge because I'm being driven crazy by these free-floating, unanchored conjectures about Renaissance texts. You know, what do you mean that this is what Spencer is doing in the Amoretti and it's all about numerology? And the number, and then the numbers don't even add up. It's not even the right number, but it's close to this number that you think has this other significance, and you're off. And it just drove her crazy. And then we come to New Testament scholarship, and we find, again, what is the primary argument? Well, it's literary interpretation, often interpretation that in the cold light of day looks rather forced.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we can't underestimate the importance of social dynamics and fashion, even within a field. They play a much larger role than we would like to think as outsiders that they play. Mm-hmm. Even within the sciences, there's a certain amount of resistance to an idea that arises simply from the fact that that's not what we all talk about when we get together at our conferences, right? But within philological studies, within New Testament scholarship, this actually, this is all over the place. You find people saying, this is what we believe. This is what we all talk about at our conferences. Of course, we talk about layers of redaction in Q. Of course, we talk about, you know, how it came about that we have this thing. And the how it came about is not tied down. We have hypothetical documents, and sometimes they proliferate. Oh, now we've got, you know, special Luke and special Matthew, and then those are also sources. How many documents do you have to invent?
It's like dark matter in cosmology.
I often point to that, and I say, if later there's a place where people are going to come back and they're going to say, that was weird, why did people go for that? I'm going to say somewhere maybe in the dark matter thing, it's not that there's not phenomena that we're looking at, but that conjecture just seems kind of like it. Well, this would make our bookkeeping come out right. Well, that's a thing, I guess, but it's not. It's certainly not decisive.
Right.
And so, when you're just free floating, conjecturing about these things, when you're building out some kind of conjecture, at a certain point, we want to invoke Occam's razor. We want to say, well, now you've invoked a whole editorial team and a community. There's a Matthean community and a Johannine community. And how's all this supposed to work out when we are bringing this back to the test of simplicity? Because honestly, very few ancient books that we have actual evidence about were written by a committee. Right. Yeah, Josephus had some Greek scribes and style critics to help him, but Josephus is still the author of the War, right?
That's right.
They're not written by committees, and yet now suddenly, well, since we're going to reject the reports of the church fathers regarding who wrote these things, let's just invent whole communities with redactors upon redactors who are putting these things into this form, and let's squint real hard and tip our heads and try to see fault lines across the narratives. And to somebody who's come out of literary criticism and been kind of sick to death of that kind of stuff, to see this coming back up and treat it as this is...
It's a zombie. It's an exegetical zombie.
Right. You drive a stake through its heart and it gets back up. Like, right. Come on, guys. This is not scholarship that is being done. The term falsifiability gets thrown around a lot, and maybe it's a little rigid in the way it's used sometimes, but there is something to the idea that your hypothesis should be able to take it on the chin if it's wrong. But no, it's always, well, but I can tweak that by adding this additional parameter,
right?
When we see that kind of curve fitting going on in the sciences, we say you're adding effectively epicycles to make it fit the data. And at a certain point, that's going to collapse under its own weight.
Bob Price was on the book club last year. Mythicist.
Sure. Sort of a mythicist. I guess he's modified that slightly.
He's
now,
a
right?
little bit. But I asked Bob, because there's this concept, I know you're aware of it, called parallelomania in mythicism. And I wanted to ask, he wasn't too happy when I used the term, but
sure.
I wanted to point to a specific example in his writing because it speaks about what you're saying to him. He said he took an inscription from the Asclepius about somebody being healed. Now, this is 4th century BC. I don't know the date, but it preceded Luke's account in the road to Emmaus in Luke 24 by centuries. Okay, so it's prior to Luke 24. And Bob just goes, you know, here's this inscription at the Asclepius. It reminds me of Luke's account of the road to Emmaus when Jesus appears to the disciples. Therefore, touchdown. You know, there's the connection. I said, Bob, can you connect the dots for me about how we went from Asclepius to Emmaus? And tell me, what is it, because Luke is a physician and the Asclepius is about healing? How are you making this centuries, the bridge over these 2 centuries? And it just seems to me that, and that's what he would say. Every time we would ask him about something, it just seems to me that...
Well, it just doesn't seem to me, right. So now where are we?
Dale Allison the same way. I said, Dale, how do you tell what's history and what's not in the scripture? Well, there's just some history in the Bible, and then there's just not some history in the Bible. And like, well, can you give me some grist
that I can hold on to about right, making these distinctions.
What's the criterion exactly by which we do that? And it had better not be, this can't be history because that would be inconvenient for my favorite hypothesis. That's not a good criterion.
Before we go here, I just thought I'd ask you a question real quick. I've been burning to ask you every time, and when I do, I forget. A lot of the objection to the Gospels especially come up because of the synoptic, what we call the synoptic problem, that
right,
why do the three authors, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, why do they borrow or copy or however you want to term that? Why do we have such similar wording and in fact so many places exact wording?
Almost exact wording
yeah, in these three different gospel accounts. What do you think is the real reason for that?
Okay, well, let's dial up the resolving power of our microscope and look at this a little bit more intently. First of all, the wording is very rarely absolutely word for word, though it is often similar enough to make us say, well, there's some degree of literary dependence here. But literary dependence is one thing and factual dependence is a different thing.
Okay.
So let's just take for an example the one that I brought up. We have an account in Mark of the death of John the Baptist and of Herod's saying something at the beginning of it. We have an account like that in Matthew. In some respects, the accounts are rather similar. In fact, they're most similar when they are citing someone's exact words, where we would use quotation marks today.
Right.
Those are the places where the accounts are almost word for word. And yet, Matthew has this additional factual bit to his servants. So it seems to me plausible that in the course of the production of what we have as our Greek Gospel of Matthew, there was some use of the narrative framework in Mark. But that does not mean that what is in Matthew is wholly factually dependent on Mark, even when they're doing the same, as we say, pericope, mm-hmm, because there are these little nuggets that you find sometimes in Matthew that just aren't there in the other Gospels. Mm-hmm. So literary dependence may have been the product of taking an original Aramaic Gospel, which is what all the church fathers say was the language in which Matthew's Gospel was originally published, and transforming it into something that could be more widely read in the diaspora by Jews who were not fluent in Aramaic but were reading Greek.
Let me pause you for just a second. It was fascinating what you just said. It just made a connection. Tell me if it's legitimate. So Matthew's original Gospels, according to the church fathers, was Aramaic.
Mm-hmm.
So are we talking about instead of Q, it's much more likely we had Aramaic Matthew?
This is one of the things to which a lot of the people who are now bringing up doubts about whether there ever was a Q independent of things that we actually have described in the church fathers, right?
Yeah.
So not just a hypothetical document, but an Aramaic Matthew that may have contained a lot of Jesus' sayings that weren't in Mark.
Yeah.
Sure. And so if you read, you know, Mark Goodacre and N.T. Wright has joined on to this and some others, they're making arguments that the whole two-source hypothesis of Streeter and the whole notion of an independent but now lost Q source, which we have to then reconstruct by seeing these overlappings of things. That is quite plausibly just not even a thing.
Dark matter, dark energy.
Right. Well, we hypothesized this because we didn't want to go with what the church fathers said. Now, it is true that in our Greek version of Matthew, there's quite a high degree of finish to it. There are sometimes plays on words in the Greek. And it's hard to see how those would have arisen originally in the Aramaic, though perhaps they did, or perhaps this is something parallel, but perhaps that's just something that
Matthew threw in some Greek on top of his Aramaic.
Maybe. And Jesus may not have spoken only Aramaic. There's, I think, a reasonable case. Stanley Porter has made some really good arguments that Jesus was multilingual and at times spoke Greek and at times spoke Aramaic and depended on his audience. He's, you know, when he's meeting with Nicodemus by night in John 3, Nicodemus is a Greek name.
I'm thinking the Logos probably has a handle on language.
Yeah, I think. So, but it's even just plausible that he would speak
absolutely
to a guy with a Greek name in Greek.
Right.
And so to say, well, we know Jesus was speaking Aramaic there. Do we?
Do we know?
You know, again, yeah, just, you know, back out. But the sheer amount of conjecture involved, unverifiable conjecture in saying, well, this is this hypothetical document, I think arises out of a disdain for the patristic evidence, the early church fathers' evidence. In fact, if you take Bart Ehrman's textbook, his undergraduate textbook, An Introduction to the New Testament.
The one he did with Metzger?
No, this is the Oxford University Press one, solo author. Okay.
Okay.
Look through it to see what he has to say about the patristic evidence for the authorship of the New Testament. And the answer is nothing. He doesn't have any of it. He doesn't have any of the evidence at all. He never even so much as mentions the fact that these guys said, oh, these are the authors. He leaves it out. He doesn't cite it and then argue against it. He just omits all of it. Wow. I struggle to think of any other philological discipline in which ignoring the earliest actual testimony we have to the authorship of documents would be considered to be good historical practice.
I didn't even know that. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, I'll send you my copy of the textbook if you want to see it. It's pretty shocking.
Wow. Wow.
I went through the whole thing. I looked up in the index. Some of the names appear in the index, but never what they said about the authorship of the books.
Wow.
That's all left to literary conjecture, and we have omitted the hard evidence we would use in every other historical.
He brought up in our book club when I had asked him the question and he was trying to tell me I was making an argument, he brought up a source that he didn't think I would know. And I forgot what it was, but I said, well, that guy came. I forgot his name. It was a guy that very much looked like Jesus, but it was created after the resurrection.
Apollonius of Tyana.
Apollonius, thank you.
Right.
And he brings up Apollonius, and I had just read about that, and I said, well, Bart, he came after Jesus, and it looked more like that Apollonius was something of a creation after Christ and resurrected.
Right.
Oh, well, but he threw that in there, like, he's not going to know about this. And I think that's what he does with the general public in sense that...
He tried to do it with me in our debate with the Baal Shem Tov, and I was like, yeah, okay, let's go there.
Yeah.
And he didn't like that. He wanted to catch me flat-footed, and he was trying the same thing on you.
Yeah.
But he's got this little stock of examples. You know, old books. Can I give you for the notes to accompany the podcast here, can I give you a link to John Douglas's book, The Criterion?
Oh, please. I was just going to ask you for...
an extensive discussion of the parallels with Apollonius of Tyana, how Philostratus wrote it, when he wrote it.
Yes.
Oh, it's brilliant and beautiful. So John Douglas, The Criterion, I'll send you a link to a copy of that on the Library of Historical Apologetics, which I maintain, and you can link people directly to it and tell them what pages to go to,
that.
And they can read all about it.
Let's do that. Send it. That's what my next question I was going to ask. We could just go on for hours, but you got to get on an airplane here. And I would just like to have you give us some general final thoughts for Christians that encounter arguments against the New Testament and why we can, you know, how we can approach that. But ultimately, too, give us a couple of... references that we might be able to resource, and I'll put those, in addition to you mentioning them, I'll put them in the notes of the description of our episode.
First piece of advice would be, do not get hung up on the fact that there is an argument that you don't know how to answer. There's always going to be another argument and another and another.
Takes the pressure off when you say it that way.
You need to understand that the question is not, can you answer every objection to Christianity, but on which side do the greater difficulties lie?
Yeah.
When you realize that we're talking here not about knockdown mathematical proofs, but about the kind of evidence that we have in every historical inquiry, which is a non-deductive inference, weight of evidence, balance of evidence. When you do a criminal trial, the standard is never beyond all possible doubt. There's always some possible way of coming up with some alternative explanation, however wacky. The standard is beyond reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
And if you hold to that, then you won't get hung up by the existence of one objection that you don't know the answer to. Second thing, don't do this alone.
Yeah.
There is a great cloud of witnesses behind you who have done a lot of scholarship in many of the common objections that people have, that they come up with, that they hear thrown at them, have already been answered and well answered. Know that. So to that end, I wish that everybody would read things like William Paley's View of the Evidences of Christianity, or John Douglas's Criterion, or
read old books.
Yeah, John James Blunt's book, Undesigned Coincidences. If you want a modern version of that that deals with the textual critical issues, go to my wife's book, Lydia McGrew, Hidden in Plain View from D. Ward. So that's a book that's 5 or 6 years old now, but that covers this line of argument from Undesigned Coincidences in considerable detail. And you can't appreciate the force of it well until you've seen multiple examples of it and you begin to get the sense of this interlocking web these things, and you realize this really is a cumulative case. That's only one kind of internal evidence, and there's external evidence as well. But don't do this alone. Like I said, I was the son of a Bible college professor. I went to the Bible college for a couple of years. I took the Bible classes. I never saw any of this. This was all new to me when I began reading books by dead people. And that really transformed my view of it. But don't try to go out and Lone Ranger it. There is a community, living and dead, of people who work on these things.
Right.
Tap into that. Find answers that you yourself might never have come up with, but that seem cogent.
Right.
Don't accept an answer just because it's put forward on your side. Make sure that it can become your own.
And I think the temptation today, especially, Tim, here, you know, we're here at Defend, and majority of the audience here is young people that are social media, have been born into the era of social media. And the temptation is to kind of go Lone Ranger with the social media platforms, my YouTube channel, my Facebook page, but there's an inherent danger in going.
Yeah.
That's, I love being at Watchmen. I love being able to talk to people. I love doing this in community. You need community.
Absolutely.
Because in isolation, things assail you very easily. You know, the Satan or the enemy or atheist, you can get very discouraged.
Sure.
And it's one of the blessings that I love about Defend and the ministry that we have at Watchmen is meeting and engaging with people and reminding ourselves that we're on a team.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
That's the beauty of it. Final thoughts, Tim, and we'll get you in the air here.
Yeah, final thoughts. Man, I wish we could do this more often. That's one of the final thoughts. Second final thought is I need to know where you're getting your coffee. That was excellent.
Okay.
And I hope other people enjoyed their coffee as they were listening to us as much as we enjoyed it while we were talking. And again, just reinforce those two things. Don't get hung up on a single objection you don't know how to answer. Don't try to do it alone. There are resources out there. There are people out there. There are living and dead people out there that you need to get to know.
Absolutely.
And when you do, you'll find that the evidence is weave a tough safety net beneath our beliefs.
Absolutely.
It's not all just dependent on this one link in this one chain, and if that link breaks, everything comes down. It's a lot more like a trampoline than like a chain.
So
there's a lot of woven support beneath it, but you need to come to understand that, and you can master little pieces of it. You don't have to become a great master of all of it, but you can learn one undesigned coincidence a month, if it takes you that long to wrap your head around it. Like, make that a plan, and then at the end of the year, you'll find you got a dozen of these things.
Right.
And that is not a small achievement. So you can approach it in bite-sized chunks, and a cumulative case is beautiful that way, because that's exactly how it proceeds.
Mm-hmm.
But when you begin to see how they all fit together, it will change your view of the evidences of Christianity.
Well, one thing, and talking to Lydia about this last year, I remember, and this is just an aside, I know it's within John, so I don't know if it counts as an undesigned coincidence, but it but thinking of an undesigned coincidence is, I thought of John 2 and John 6, where in John 2 we get this one sentence detail, the disciples were off buying food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to John 6, and Jesus asked Philip, where are we going to buy food for these people? John is setting us up. And I thought that I'd never seen that before.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yep.
And I'm thinking the disciples are always running off buying snacks.
Hey, somebody's got to do it, right? So,
but that's sure. it was a catalyst for me to see Scripture in a way that I had not seen before.
Right.
So that's
even within a single document. The danger is that somebody will say, well, it was all written by one person, so he could have been really cagey and done it all in his own document. But sometimes you could just tell this was not done to line up with that. This is just something that came along in the course of the narrative.
Coffee, by the way, just for you and our listeners, Starbucks espresso, full beans, ground before I brew them in a French press with filtered water. And that's what I do. So it's been fun having coffee with Tim McGrew. Philosopher at Eastern Michigan?
Western
Michigan.
Western Michigan.
I always get the direction. So, Western Michigan University philosopher, author, husband of Lydia, Gentleman and a scholar, thanks for being on Apologetics Profile with us, Tim.
My pleasure.
This episode of Apologetics Profile has been a production of Watchman Fellowship Incorporated, Arlington, Texas. For more information on this and any of our other podcast episodes or resources, visit watchman.org today.